It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
In keeping with President Reagan's legacy, I do not ask about a nominee's personal opinions. What matters is not a judge's political views, but whether they can set aside those views to do what the law and the Constitution require. I am pleased to say that I have found, without doubt, such a person. Tonight, it is my honor and privilege to announce that I will nominate Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court.
It's very hard to believe that that was just about 1 year ago. Sandy Rios with you this morning. And the events of Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation, his nomination by President Trump, the ensuing circus that took place, and circus is actually too nice of a word, more like the circus that was Rome, and almost brutality. Unbelievable things happening in the nation's capital in hearing rooms with a man, Brett Kavanaugh, with the attempt to destroy him and his life and nearly actually succeeding. Many of us lived through that. We watched it. I think most of you probably did. We certainly covered it so much on this show, and yet not as much as my next two guests. Because they were on, had a front row seat to probably every minute, every day, carrying the burden of reporting and trying to carry through this nomination in various ways. And they have now partnered together to write a book called Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court. And the two women I'm going to introduce, and I just want to say editorially before I do this, these are two of my favorite women in the world in Washington, D.C. They have both collectively have so much wisdom, and the fact that they pooled their knowledge for this book means that the product here is going to be incredible in every way. By the way, it's on Amazon's bestseller list in all categories since even the day before it came out. The book, again, is called Justice on Trial, and my guests, the authors of this book, are Molly Hemingway. Molly is the senior editor of The Federalist. She's a senior journalism fellow at Hillsdale College. You know her as a Fox News contributor because you see her almost every night. Let me just say that she has written her work has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, Los Angeles Times, and you know I could go on and on. National Review. Molly is just a great mind, a great thinker. And so, Molly, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here with you.
All right. Let me also introduce Carrie Severino. Carrie, you've heard many times on this show. I want to say that Carrie is Chief Counsel and Policy Director of the Judicial Crisis Network. Carrie has testified before Congress on many, many issues. She's been extensively quoted in media. I know that because I've probably read you her quotes. She did, during the Kavanaugh hearings, over 100 television interviews alone in support of Brett Kavanaugh. The Judicial Crisis Network was working on trying to get him confirmed. She was previously, among other things, a law clerk to U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. And there's so much more to say about Carrie, but this one little personal note, Carrie, is about, I'm not sure, she's 5 foot something, almost nothing. And when I first met her, she was always pregnant and always carrying a baby. She is a dynamo, and she is so highly respected in D.C. And so, Carrie, we welcome you this morning, too.
Thanks, Sandy. 5 foot
All right.
One.
Pardon?
5 foot one. I got a whole extra inch there.
5 foot one. Okay, I'm glad you clarified that. All right. Molly, let me ask you first. You know, there are have been in the last several years so many crises to cover. Whether, you know, we could even just go back a couple of years and say the 2016 elections, the Russian collusion intelligence agency debacle. And I know that you cover each and every one of those faithfully. I try to, too. And that means you kind of live and breathe it. But this situation, less than a year ago now, the trial itself, as you covered it on a daily basis, I'm curious to know how it compared for you to covering the other things. Was it different? Was it special? Was there something unique about following that?
Absolutely. And I think that the thing that made it unique and different was why we wanted to write a book about it, which was, you cover all these stories, they can be frustrating, they can be horrific even. There was nothing quite as emotional as what I think the country went through with this Kavanaugh confirmation debacle. It wasn't just about seeing a man having his, you know, life's reputation trashed without substantiation, but our entire country's support of rule of law and due process, and seeing so many people who you thought knew better, who you thought, you know, we might disagree politically, but at least we share this. Seeing that that wasn't true, I think it was scary and frightening for a lot of people, and that it was very important to see the nomination through just so that that mob mentality wouldn't work. And we knew when we started, well, we wanted to write Justice on Trial because we knew we had a good story, but we also knew there were important other issues in play. And we interviewed more than 100 people. We interviewed the president and many other people at the White House. We interviewed members of the Supreme Court, senators, people, everyone involved in the process. We thought we knew a lot about the story, but we realized we didn't even know the half of it. And getting that inside account from so many different angles, it was very thrilling for Carrie and for me.
You know, just at a practical level, Molly, can you just briefly give people an idea of what it's like when an event like this is going on? I mean, you're married, you have a family. What it requires from you, what you actually, how you put pedal to the metal, how you are an expert every night on this, how does that happen?
Well, it's almost like drinking from a fire hose or resisting a tsunami. It was interesting on this story because up seemed to become down as the media just misreported everything, and that's something we talk about a lot because it happens a lot. But in this case, it was so dramatic. We have this story in the book about how the Kavanaughs are dealing with the, you know, the allegations coming out. And there is this night where the final supposed witness to the allegation comes out and says what all the other supposed witnesses say, which is she doesn't remember anything of the sort, and she can't corroborate Christine Blasey Ford's story. And so Christine Blasey Ford had four witnesses, and all four say they don't know what she's talking about. And when that happens, this last witness is an actual friend of Blasey Ford, a lifelong friend of hers. The Kavanaughs see that and they think, well, this is the big thing. Like, of course the media coverage will change now. And instead, the media barely notice it and just keep going. And they just keep coming out with increasingly ridiculous allegations. And to experience that as a reporter was just amazing because it's like you're battling on all fronts, this like campaign of misinformation. And there are just a few reporters who are willing to evaluate the facts and remember things like, well, okay, so someone's made an allegation. What evidence is there in support of it? You know, normal basic things you would do weren't being done. And it was quite a bit to go through. When we interviewed people too, they would say something like, well, this happened this day. And then a week later, this happened. And we would go through the calendar with them and we'd realize the thing that they thought had been a week later had been only a day later.
Oh, yes.
Time seemed to slow down, and people, you know, it was only about a month start to finish, and really only a couple weeks for the heavy part. But people just felt like they lived entire lifetimes during that period.
Yep, I agree. And yet, funny, isn't it? I think to think now that this dramatic event happened less than a year ago, and it seems in some ways because of all the other events. It seems like ages. So it's odd how time plays tricks on your mind. Carrie, I want to ask you, at the Judicial Crisis Network, you had a really front row seat because your job, in part at least, is to usher through conservative candidates for lots of courts, other federal positions. And so this is like your wheelhouse. This is what you do. So I'm wondering, you know, your observations about how this one was different.
Yeah, I mean, I was going as the confirmation was getting started and talking to people so everyone would know what to expect. And we've seen some of these, this general playbook used before. I told people he's going to have his record misconstrued. And they certainly did. They're going to people who say, you know, like they did with Justice Gorsuch, he had a case where he ruled against a trucker who was in a frozen car. Well, he wants people to die freezing in their cars. You know, things like that. That, of course, happened. We said they're going to make apocalyptic predictions that aren't attached to reality about what will happen with if he's on the court. And we tell about some of those in Justice on Trial. But I always held myself back. I said, you know, they're probably going to engage in the politics of personal destruction. But I always held back from saying, and this could be the worst confirmation process in history. Because even though we have seen such intensity of the partisanship in our politics, I clerked for Justice Thomas. I knew how bad it got. And I really thought nothing is going to compare with Justice Thomas's confirmation. And I'm sorry to say I was wrong on that point. This actually amazingly got more ugly than the Thomas confirmation. We thought, you know, as Molly said, it's so funny how your memory plays tricks. As we were talking to people for the book, oftentimes they would misremember and say, oh, it was pretty smooth sailing until things got crazy in September. And then you remind them, this was actually a wild process beforehand. Historic levels of documents being requested, crazy requests like every document the White House produced in all of the time he was working there, which doesn't have anything to do with his own work. You know, things like that. The protesters that were standing up and hundreds of people getting arrested during his confirmation hearings. The violation of Senate rules, you know, Spartacus Booker there who was releasing confidential documents. All of these things that really were historically bizarre, and all of that in comparison to what happened later seemed like, you know, it was a drop in the bucket. So it was a surreal time to live through. And, you know, at times we thought this just when you think it's not going to get crazier, it does. But, you know, the good news is at the end of the day, he did get confirmed. And that is at least something to help prevent it happening in the future. It doesn't give them the victory of having defeated him. But what we're concerned about is they did, in many ways, gain a victory of forever tainting his reputation, of the damage they have done to the process, to the way the Senate and the White House work together, and to our nation in terms of dragging them through this kind of a process. So we want people to be aware of what happened so that we can hopefully hold people accountable and then be able to prevent it from happening again.
Carrie, just to underscore what you just said, I remember after he was confirmed, there was even news reports about speculating about whether he should be allowed to coach girls' teams because of these mm-hmm. allegations that were made. I mean, really probably going, I'm guessing, to the heart of his tenderness. He's a good man who loves his kids and loves coaching, and probably as wounding as anything that happened in that particular trial. I want to talk about the 100 people, the over 100 people that you guys interviewed. And as I understand it, some of them spent as much as 10 hours with you, and many of them you cannot name. They gave the information to you that you could verify, but you can't use their name. Molly, we only have a couple of minutes before the break here, but which of those 100-plus people was really the most, to you, drop-dead moment? Who had the most incredible story to tell?
Well, it really was, as a reporter, one of the highlights of my career to be able to do these interviews. I personally found our interviews with the Supreme Court justices to be just amazing. It's a rare thing to get to speak to a Supreme Court justice, much less interview them, and getting their perspective, which is both personal. You know, they're dealing with actual, like, people trying to tear down the Supreme Court, and protesters throwing tomatoes at cars and, you know, this type of thing. But they're also concerned with such high-level issues about the direction of the country, about rule of law, about the importance of institutions. They have a broad scope of history when they are talking to you. They remember their own confirmation hearings. And that was interesting to us, I think. It wasn't just people who had notoriously bad hearings, but even the ones who didn't have notoriously bad hearings. They all remember them as bad and not, you know, as really horrific moments.
Molly, let me interrupt you for a second because we have to take this break. But that's the voice of Molly Hemingway, and she, along with Carrie Severino, have just written this book, Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court. And we're going to get to many more things about the details of their book that you may not have known. You may think you know a great deal about it. I thought I did, but there's so much more. And so they'll return with me after this break. Sandy Rios in the morning.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Thank you, Chairman Grassley and Ranking Member Feinstein, members of the committee. My name is Christine Blasey Ford. I am a professor of psychology at Palo Alto University and a research psychologist at the Stanford University School of Medicine. I won't detail my educational background since it has already been summarized. I have been married to Russell Ford since 2002, and we have two children. I am here today not because I want to be. I am terrified. I am here because I believe it is my civic duty to tell you what happened to me while Brett Kavanaugh and I were in high school. I have described the events publicly before. I summarized them in my letter to Ranking Member Feinstein and again in a letter to Chairman Grassley. I understand and appreciate the importance of your hearing from me directly about what happened to me and the impact that it has had on my life and on my family. I grew up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. I attended the Holton Arms School in Bethesda, Maryland from 1978 to 1984. Holton Arms is an all-girls school that opened in 1901. During my time at the school, girls at Holton Arms frequently met and became friendly with boys from all boys' schools in the area, including the Landon School, Georgetown Prep, Gonzaga High School, as well as our country clubs and other places where kids and families socialized. This is how I met Brett Kavanaugh, the boy who sexually assaulted me.
All right, that was the opening statement, at least in part, of Christine Blasey Ford. You will remember, we did play it. You will probably remember me mocking her repeatedly. I could not believe that a grown woman would speak like that. That's not exactly the most important thing to come out of that, but boy, it was alarming and concerning given the circus that was taking place in that hearing room. We're talking about this book that just came out this very week, Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court. And it's been written by Molly Hemingway and Carrie Severino, who both had a front row seat to what was taking place. You guys actually wrote some things about Christine Blasey Ford that you discovered that obviously were not reported by the media. So, Carrie, let me go to you. What don't we know about Christine Blasey Ford that you have included in your book?
Well, you know, one thing, just to your point about her voice, that we were interested to learn is, we had people who knew her at the time who said, oh yeah, actually some people called her Baby Love because the way she talked. So that, you know, that we learned that that voice maybe is actually how she normally speaks. And I think people, some people were concerned that wasn't the truth. But we did also learn there were a lot of things that the White House and the Senate knew about her that they strategically chose not to use. You know, D.C. and the suburbs, it's actually a really small town in a lot of ways, and a lot of people who knew both the Blaseys and the Kavanaughs and Brett and Christine growing up still live in the area. They still are friends and talk to each other. So there was a lot of discussion going on about the contrast between the way they remembered that summer and the way that it was being portrayed. And in the kind of rollout of these allegations, they described Christine Blasey as someone who actually was a heavy drinker and was very aggressive with boys, more so than her peers were. And they reached out to senators and to the White House saying, hey, the way she's being portrayed isn't really accurate in our perspective. And that's something that there was a strategic decision not to pursue on the part of those advancing the nomination. They knew that the media would have taken that and portrayed it as them attacking Blasey Ford, and they felt that that was not something that was worth pointing out in the context of the environment they were dealing with. So they had to go forward without using that information, but trying to just make the points about the insubstantial allegations, the fact that they were not able to be corroborated, and so in effect weren't even able to use all of the information that they had.
Well, many of us, I think, what you also, I think, have included in your book, and by the way, you know, I haven't read it yet, but I will. I read parts of it, and I just haven't had a chance to read it because it's so fresh off the press. But I do know that you guys talk about how many, many women did not believe Christine Blasey Ford. And of course, I was one of them. It was just disgusting to me the way she was being deferred to, even by Chairman Grassley at the beginning of the hearing. She seemed like a fraud to me from the very beginning. But Molly, you say a word about that. What did you guys find? And I know that you actually at least knew about Melania Trump's response to her performance. Say a word about those things, please.
Well, first off, we thought it was interesting that when we would interview people, just in general, the men we spoke to were more likely to say that she was at least credible than the women we spoke to. And there was an example of this in part when we learned that Melania Trump says to her husband midway through the hearing, "You know that woman is lying, don't you?" And I just thought it was interesting that, yes, even at the highest levels of our government, you have the same type of conversations that are happening in all of our homes as well, where, you know, in the media presentation, this woman was so credible. You know, we had a quote from one reporter who had said on air something like, "The holes in her story made her seem more credible," which is not how these things work, of course. But in normal households, you were having discussions like, "I don't think this sounds right. This doesn't add up. There's no evidence to support these allegations. There's a lot of evidence that goes against these allegations." And, you know, I think women are more sensitive to sexual assault, and we know people who've gone through it, or we ourselves have gone through it. And we know how that goes with excruciating detail, meaning when we talk to our friends who've gone through it, they, you know, they remember where it happened. They remember how they got home. And so not having those things made it, for a lot of women, I think, less believable. Whereas men, I don't know if they were trying to be deferential or whatnot, they didn't have the same problems that a lot of women did.
Did you guys interview, okay, now that's one thing for us to talk, you and me, the three of us, because we're kind of on the same page about things. But it's another thing to talk to women on the left. And I'm just curious to know if you had any conversations with any women on the left in the aftermath of this to write your book.
We did.
Yeah, we talked.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead,
Carrie. Carrie, why don't you answer first? Okay.
Sure. Yeah, we did, in fact. We spoke with women who didn't want to see Kavanaugh confirmed, but nonetheless had issues with Blasey Ford's story. We spoke with women who were very liberal, but nonetheless thought that he actually had demonstrated that he was a solid justice. And we talked with people who knew him and who knew her around the time. So it was really amazing to see those range. We tell one story of a liberal lawyer. She's one of the top Supreme Court advocates. She's won almost every case she's brought. Lisa Blatt, who testified for Judge Kavanaugh before the court and talked about how challenging it was when her other liberal friends, who agreed with her on politics but disagreed with her on Kavanaugh, were refusing to remain friends with her in the wake of it. And we saw that time and again with people who were worried about speaking out on this. I mean, Lisa Blatt certainly wasn't. She's a very confident woman and just said, you know, take me or leave me. This is who I am. But a lot of people were concerned because there is such a campaign of silencing going on in this and other issues that they were worried if they said what they really thought about these issues that they would get a lot of pushback. And we know women who certainly did, like Leland Kaiser, who is also someone that was named in this by the allegations of Christine Blasey Ford, was her longtime friend. And also herself, a liberal Democrat, didn't want to see Kavanaugh on the court. But nonetheless, her memory of that summer, though it was very good on other details, did not remember anything like what Christine Blasey Ford described. And she experienced a lot of pressure that we detail in that group in that book to change her story, to say that she maybe did have memories of it. She somehow supported Chrissy Ford. That was really an interesting, you know, angle to the story to bring out.
Took a lot of courage for her not to support. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, we saw the wickedness of the opposition. We saw what they were willing to do. And so to be a liberal and to come out and not be in full support of Christine Blasey Ford under these circumstances, with as much as was at stake through Kavanaugh's nomination, took a lot of courage. No question about that. Molly, you were talking about, of all the people that you guys interviewed, the people that really stood out to you were the Supreme Court justices. And I would love to hear more about that. You said that their perspective, because they had these lofty thoughts about the implications to the country and all of that. But were there any specific things that you think about when you think about your times talking with them?
Well, there's so much there, but I thought what was interesting was how much they care about the legitimacy of the Supreme Court and how they think about how important it is to have that and how it is had. And a lot of people looked at what was happening in the Senate and they thought it was a circus or they didn't like the behavior of the media or whatnot. But the court itself is responsible for its legitimacy as well. And it has legitimacy in part by understanding its proper role, which is not to make political decisions, but rather to just decide the law on the basis of the law. And as the court has gotten more political, as it has run roughshod over the people, you know, forcing issues that the people have voted against, it has hurt the legitimacy of the court. And it's a very big picture issue. But this story about the Kavanaugh battle is in part about that battle for the court. Whether you think as a progressive that the court should be, redefining marriage or saying that abortion is found in the Constitution, you know, things that are very much at odds with what our founding understanding of the court is, which is that these justices are to decide the law on the basis of the law, that they should make sure that they don't become more political, that if a legislature has made a law, that even if they disagree with that law, they make sure that their decisions support and uphold those things. That was very interesting.
We've talked about a lot of the characters surrounding the issue, but we have not really have given or reminded people of Brett Kavanaugh's voice in all of this. We have a very short clip. I thought this was one of the most moving moments of his entire testimony, and that's saying a lot because there were a lot of moving moments. Let's play clip 5, Adam.
I am innocent of this charge. I intend no ill will to Dr. Ford and her family. The other night, Ashley and my daughter Liza said their prayers, and little Liza, all of 10 years old, said to Ashley, we should pray for the woman. It's a lot of wisdom from a 10-year-old. We mean no ill will.
Carrie, there's a story behind that emotional part of his testimony. Can you give us some idea of what was happening there?
Yeah, in our reporting for this book, we learned not only how much time he spent outlining that speech, rehearsing it, because as emotional as he was, you know, the first time reading through it was even harder to get through. So, but also how that important phrase got added as they were on their way, the Kavanaughs were on their way to the hearing. That's when he learned this story, because Liza was saying her prayers with her mother that night. It was the day that she had let her know about the, obviously as delicate a way as she could, but about the allegations that were being made against her father. And she told him that, and he said, I think you should include it. And he absolutely agreed and took out a Sharpie and then edited his speech right then and there to include that now famous line about Liza. And it was really, you know, a moment where everyone in the room and a lot of people who were there talked about how intense it was being in that space where you even have people on the left in tears. You had Alyssa Milano tearing up, who is the actress who was, you know, helping advocate for the opposition. We had so many men we talked to who were in that room who would say, you know, don't tell anyone this, but honestly, I was starting to break up there. And we started to laugh because by the end, practically every person we spoke to in the room said they were in tears at this point. So no shame there. It was incredibly moving and powerful moment for the nation to see that.
I can just vouch for that. I would just say that to me, God entered that courtroom then, and all the voices were silenced. Even the voices of opposition. I'm sorry, I have to put that spin on it. Yeah. I believe it's true. God just really found a presence in that. And Brett Kavanaugh was the one who, uttered those words. I thought it was a profound moment. Molly, we just have a couple of minutes. Do you have anything to add to that before the break?
I do. One of the things we found utterly, it shook us almost, was learning about how Brett Kavanaugh was a lector in his church right before he gets the nomination. And the passage he's reading is from 1 Corinthians about how God is giving power in weakness. And he kind of thinks this is helpful for him not getting the nomination. We see that it was helpful for what he was about to endure. We later realized in rereading Clarence Thomas's book, it was the same passage that Clarence Thomas meditated on before he went out for his testimony. Oh, I just love it.
I do too. That's amazing. And so the other thing before we take this break, my understanding from your book is that Brett Kavanaugh was being given two different sets of advice. Say a word about that, Carrie.
Yeah, there were a lot of people who Kavanaugh knew. Obviously, he worked intensely in the Bush White House, as did his wife, who was Bush's personal secretary. They had a lot of friends who worked for the Bushes. But then there's also a lot of people who are here in the Trump White House and running these nominations from that perspective. A few people who even are in both camps. But you did have some difference in opinion of the strategy between what got called the Bushies and their approach, which was much more slower, calmer, saying let's just be polite about this, and then the Trump approach, which is much more let's fight. We have to stand up and really be strong on this. And you have a moment where White House Counsel Don McGahn is saying you're a Trump nominee and Trump fight.
Yeah, so I have to interrupt you just to say, and he chose to fight. And I think that made all the difference in the world personally. My guests are Molly Hemingway and Carrie Severino. The new book is called Justice on Trial. It's something that you don't want to miss. We'll be right back. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Call it Kavanaugh derangement syndrome.
Was Brett Kavanaugh known at Yale as a virgin?
I have no idea.
The relentless attacks normally directed at President Trump are now being aimed at Judge Brett Kavanaugh.
I think he's been very brutally treated.
Like a Politico op-ed entitled Law and Order, Why the FBI Should Investigate Boofing. Co-authored by Brian Fallon, a former spokesman for both Hillary Clinton and Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer. Or this USA Today column, suggesting Kavanaugh should no longer be allowed to serve as a basketball coach for young girls. The paper issued a clarification, but the viciousness stunned a son of the late Justice Antonin Scalia.
That particular story was really tasteless, I thought, because, last week he was a gang rapist, and now the insinuation is he's a pedophile.
Last night, it was MSNBC airing unverified allegations of gang rape, lodged by Julie Swetnick, who backtracked on some of the accusations she previously made in a sworn statement.
I saw him around the punch, I won't say bowls, or the punch containers. I don't know what he did, but I saw him buy them.
The NBC interviewer admitted they could not corroborate it, even after Swetnick offered four names of potential witnesses.
One of them said he does not recall a Julie Swetnick. Another of the friends she named is deceased. We've reached out to the other two and haven't heard back.
Now stories by Bloomberg and the New York Times are charging that while Kavanaugh was at Yale, he threw ice at someone at a bar. Kavanaugh was questioned by the police in 1985, but not arrested. Yet a CNN anchor today suggested if he was a quote-unquote belligerent drunk, he was more likely to commit sexual assault.
I think that it's relevant to then a woman who says that you would corner her and put your hand over her mouth. Somehow that, I think, makes more sense.
A co-author of the Time story was Emily Bazelon, an opinion writer who has been savaging Kavanaugh in recent tweets, including a July tweet charging Kavanaugh is, quote, a fifth vote for a hard right turn on voting rights and so much more that will harm the democratic process and prevent a more equal society.
That was Ed Henry with Fox News, and I can hardly believe that was not even a year ago. It seems like something in our past, something that I cannot comprehend it. Ed did a great job with that report. Of course, we're talking today about the new book chronicling what happened to Justice Kavanaugh called Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court. Molly Hemingway, since you're the known writer in this bunch and the editor, for the Federalist, that has to bring back a lot of memories for you as you followed your fellow so-called journalists.
It was interesting to revisit some of those in that clip, and it's not even a half of what we saw in the bad media coverage. We talked with people who had their words misconstrued by the media. There were clerks, former clerks of Justice Kavanaugh, who said that they learned that when they were doing interviews, they had to do them live because the journalists would cut out their quotes in support of Kavanaugh if they didn't do them live. There was a text exchange where someone who was against Kavanaugh
was talking to someone who was for Kavanaugh and trying to bully her and intimidate her into saying something that she didn't believe was true. And NBC News wrote it up as if it were precisely the opposite. There were so many examples of media malfeasance, highlighting stories that never should have seen the light of day, that were clearly and obviously ridiculous, and then not highlighting stories that were the opposite. And there is a cost to that. When the media become such major leaders of an effort, and I think they really led the anti-Kavanaugh effort. They weren't just helping the anti-Kavanaugh forces. They were leading the anti-Kavanaugh forces. They lose something. They lose credibility. They lose the privilege that they have been accorded to have this position of trust in society, and they kept doing it anyway. And it was just unbelievable what had to go through. There was another thing that came to mind because there was that in that clip was Christopher Scalia talking about how the allegations were getting increasingly worse without substantiation. He at one point tweets out, "Can you imagine what it would have been like to go through this without the Federalist, National Review," and he names a few other conservative media outlets or non-liberal media outlets. And Robert Bork Jr. responds, "I can." And it was, oh, yes, I guess we can remember what it was like when the mainstream or corporate media controlled every aspect of what you heard. And without having some brave voices pushing against that, I don't think Kavanaugh would have been able to succeed.
You know, Molly, I guess if anything good came from that, we're still living through this, so I can't really declare anything, but it really did expose people further to what a propaganda machine our American media has become. And of course, we've seen it then even worse and deeper, if that's possible, with the so-called Russian collusion story and the attempt to destroy this presidency. It continues. But I do think, based on my conversations with my listeners, I believe people, there's a chink in the armor here. People, it's gotten down into the DNA of the American people that they cannot trust their media. And I think that's sad, but it's a good thing.
Oh, and I think what was interesting about this particular situation is usually when they're going out to destroy someone's character or whatnot, there's something they can hang their hat on. You know, you say Donald Trump isn't perfectly moral and 100% of the people will probably agree. But in this case, they go after Brett Kavanaugh, a guy who has been married once, whose ex-girlfriends all claim that he was very respectful toward them. And when you saw that the same game plan was used against a guy like Brett Kavanaugh, I think people realized, oh, this is, I think you used the word evil before, and I think that's an accurate word to use. This is evil, what we're seeing. And reputation does matter, and when reputation is harmed, that is a real crime, and it was sickening to watch it happen. Again, allegations do need to be investigated, and we do need to thoroughly report what is going on out there, but journalistic standards were just cast out the window.
Carrie, I want to know if you think, in all the research and your own personal observation, if there were heroes in this story.
Oh, wow. So many stories of courage. I mean, I'll just tell a couple of them. I mean, one that we were impressed with that I think it wouldn't have worked without is just Trump's courage to stand behind his nominee, because a lot of people we talked to questioned, would a different Republican president have stood behind an embattled nominee like this? So that was amazing. But there were also so many women who were really courageous in this. You know, Susan Collins, who was getting threats even before Kavanaugh was nominated. People were sending hangers to her office in veiled threats about the future of abortion in the country. And she was getting people threatening her staff. She lost staff because they couldn't take the pressure of the rape threats and the violent threats. She had someone sending, thankfully it turned out to be fake ricin, to her home. It was put on lockdown, and they had to have a weapons of mass destruction team out to address the issue. People trying to bribe her. I mean, it was a really intense thing. But she, throughout the process, and we learned she has treated him with the same respect she treated Democrat nominees as well. And, you know, Merrick Garland, she really took it very seriously. She was absolutely committed to the rule of law throughout and hearing out both sides of the story. So I think that's just one of the many examples of courage.
Molly, same question to you.
We were just so struck by people who were courageous and against their interest. Or, you know what I mean? It's one thing if you're a reflexive conservative and you're going to support whoever the nominee is, or a reflexive liberal. Those people who really went out of their way to go against their interest was striking. And for me, Susan Collins was a real mark of integrity, the way she was thorough in her investigation of Brett Kavanaugh, meaning what his judicial record was like, and the way she was refusing to be bullied by people who were violently threatening her and her staff. It was a real profile in courage.
Do you guys know, I think I've heard other people ask this, and I just hadn't thought, so much news happens, you forget and let things go. So the question is, what happened? What's happened to Christine Blasey Ford? Do you guys know? Where is she? What's she doing?
Well, one of
you know,
the
we know that
go on.
Carrie, you first.
Well, we know that she was certainly feted by those on the left in terms of, you know, receiving plaudits from Sports Illustrated, of all places, as they were introducing Rachel Ben Hollander, the woman who not just credibly accused Larry Nassar of abuse of so many women, but actually pleaded guilty to it and was actually convicted of that. So here's someone who has a real record here and is being kind of introduced in assumed to be in the same camp as Christine Blasey Ford.
Let's talk for a second, in the few minutes that we have left here, let's talk about the future, because we know that some Supreme Court justice is going to step aside. Just because of age alone and statistics, it's going to have to happen. And so the question is a broad one, really. It's about particularly nominees considering, you know, accepting the nomination. And secondly, let me ask it this way. Molly, let me ask you, since you talked to justices, how do you think this affected them, the sitting justices? What kind of effect on that court?
I actually think, for better or for worse, they are able to shut out the confirmation process once it's over. And so I think we saw it almost immediately. Once Justice Kavanaugh is confirmed, he comes over to the Supreme Court, as is the regular procedure. And usually you just get sworn in by the Chief Justice and maybe nobody else is there. In this case, some other justices who are in town show up as well. When there's the formal swearing in at the White House, they all show up. They make a show of how collegial they are on those first day of public arguments. They, you know, shake each other's hands, went up, really made it clear that Brett Kavanaugh will be viewed as a full member of the court. But you ask about the future, and I'm sure Carrie will have more to say about this, but we noticed by looking at the history, it's when you are nominating someone in a way that will shift the court in some way that you see the battles particularly come out. And that's a little sobering, because Justice Kavanaugh replaced Kennedy, a swing vote, and a pretty conservative swing vote. What happens if Donald Trump is replacing Ruth Bader Ginsburg or another member of that liberal bloc? It could be apocalyptic. And that's why we wrote Justice on Trial, because we want people to know the facts so they are prepared for when it comes again and they think about how to handle it in the future. They cannot be blindsided again. And they shouldn't be, because we've seen it before, we saw it in this case, and we're certainly going to see it again.
Carrie, I don't really know what preparations, how does one prepare for something like this? And do you think that good people will be willing to step forward and accept the nomination to the Supreme Court?
Well, you know, one interesting discussion we had also with a Supreme Court justice was we asked kind of that question. And I think a lot of people worry, you know, if Ashley Kavanaugh, we learned, was literally praying beforehand her husband wouldn't get the nomination simply because she had seen how dirty this process has become. What happens the next time? And this justice told us that, it is a horrible process, but when you think in the context of the men and women who are asked to give their lives for our country every day, if you can't, don't think you can be asked to step up, even though it is a horrible thing to have your reputation ruined and your family, you know, dragged into all of it, that we're certainly asking more every day. So I thought that was a great, you know, putting people in perspective. Nonetheless, it shouldn't be what we have to ask. That shouldn't be the cost of doing public service. So we certainly, in my job, I think one of the things I worry about is making sure that we are ready and prepared for whoever, the next nominee is, so that we have anything they need to defend themselves, because you know there's going to be a concerted public relations campaign against them. And I think part of that is, you know, reading books like Justice on Trial,
having Americans aware of what happened. Because I think if you know and recognize the playbook that has been run before, then we're not going to be fooled by it when it happens again.
You know, you wonder how much worse it could get. I guess that the next thing that comes to my mind is just violence. I mean, it's words, and it's been threats of violence, but not really violence yet. Molly, some words from you about, further words about what you think the future holds when we get to this next nomination.
I fear the same thing that you do, and I think the way to stop that is to hold people accountable. If people are not punished for making false allegations, for spreading false allegations, for violating Senate rules and procedures, why would they not do it again? And we don't have a media who hold people accountable, so we need to hold the media more accountable. We need to be more vigilant and more outraged about what happened, because if we're not, we let it happen again.
Yeah, good reason to be angry. This was a reason to get angry, and it can be an anger that can turn to something really good so that it never does happen again. The book is called Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court. Molly Hemingway, thank you every night. I love your commentary. And Carrie, I know your hard work publicly and privately, and you're a jewel to us every time you give us your perspective and your wisdom on what's happening in the court. So thank you. And thank you for this book. You guys stay safe. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.